Hi, this is Amy Haynes with This Anthropological Life. I'm here with Adam Gamwell, and this week we're going to be talking about vulnerability and empathy. At the beginning of our episode, we had a couple of technical difficulties, so we're going to be jumping in at around the 5-minute mark. This episode is anchored in a TED Talk that was given by Brené Brown. Brown is out of the University of Houston in the social work department, and she is now a very well-known researcher, educator, public speaker, and she has published on vulnerability and shame, and she gave this TED Talk, and it resonated with people around the country, and it really made the rounds on social media. And so we decided to use this talk to sort of anchor our conversation. You don't have to have listened to the TED Talk to get something out of this episode, but I definitely check it out if it's of interest to you. So we're going to jump in right now where I've asked Adam to sort of start us off by talking about what really resonated with him about this TED Talk. So take a listen.
I'd like to tag on what you just said. It's true that there's something about the fact that this TED Talk is so popular and that people want to be able to. In some ways, I mean, that's the question. Is there sort of an acknowledgement that we all have some sort of vulnerabilities that we need to be able to address? And that something like a TED Talk, which is a different kind of medium, right? Again, because usually, you know, TED stands for technology, like I think engineering or environment and design or engineering. But again, vulnerability doesn't sound like it is captured in those three in some ways, right? But at the same time, it's very much a part of the human experience. And we are the ones that create technology, you know, engineer things, design things, et cetera, et cetera. And it does sort of raise the idea of education, that's why. So the E is education. But so it does raise this interesting point of, like, why do people tag on this? And certainly it is, it's one of my favorite TED Talks. And because there's a powerfulness in terms of, like, there's an acceptance. She talks about how to live wholeheartedly. And I found that idea very attractive. And she says, like, you know, so wholeheartedly kind of comes from the courage, the word courage, you know, which is just from Latin meaning heart. And she's talking about, like, telling the story of who you are with your whole heart. And as an anthropologist as well as a human being, I mean, I find this idea very attractive because it's sort of saying, what is it – how do we tell these stories with our whole hearts, right? And then that is, like, putting emotion in it as well as, you know, the affective qualities and things that made us happy and sad as well as things we learned from it and how we put stories together. And so, I don't know, the idea of the wholeheartedness talks about authenticity. And so the things that we sort of deal with as anthropologists, right, we think about how do we get somebody's story? How do we translate it to somebody else? How do we talk about you know, different experiences across the world, but at the same time, it gets to me too, like my personal self of that, you know, we all have vulnerabilities as human beings, things we're insecure about for one, but as well as just notions of accepting that things aren't going to be perfect in some ways, right? And working as a social scientist, that can be a little tricky sometimes because the idea is how do we sort of distill social experiences that we record that seem at the time messy or chaotic into a sort of an understandable, analyzable framework. You know, and that's what, I mean, all social science does. That's what science does, too, anyway. We're trying to take, you know, seemingly universal laws and how do we codify them and talk about them? How does light work versus how does a marriage system work in Micronesia? You know, and what I liked about this notion of wholeheartedness seems to, like, it allows you to sort of sit in this mess, right, that things are not going to be perfect. And this is kind of what I hear Brown saying is that you have to allow space for both these things, that there are going to be these moments of triumph for the things that seem connected and put together, and you seem like you have a sense of control. But at the same time, a lot of times life goes away from that, and there's things that happen outside of our spheres of control, outside of even how we can use words to talk about what's happening. Michael Jackson, the anthropologist, talks about these notions of he calls it the penumbral. But I mean, what this fancy word just means is that these things that are kind of at the edge of our experience that we can be a part of them in some ways, birth, death, you know, falling in love or something, but they don't. But words don't always capture what the experience is like, right? There's something a little bit beyond that. And so to me, this wholehearted notion, the notion of wholeheartedness sort of draws into that. And like this, it's just this sort of being open to a specific kind of, you know, emotionality that there's an overwhelmingness of feelings that words don't sometimes capture that. So I'm kind of digging into Brown here a little bit with my own interpretation, but I don't know, this notion of wholeheartedness really struck me. And like, how do we sort of capture both the things that we can describe and the things that go beyond that, the ability to describe things sometimes. So what about you? What struck you about this film?
Well, I think I like how you answered that on sort of several different levels. It struck me, I'll say one, I guess, personal way and then one sort of more professional way. But the personal way, actually, it's funny because they're intertwined. The personal way is I imagine that a lot of people hear this, right? And it sort of hits close to home with one or more things that are going on in their life at the moment, where they're sort of at risk for being seen or being vulnerable. And I think about writing as a very vulnerable act in terms of what we're doing, where you, your heart is wrapped up in your ideas, right? And research and the choices that you make, why you make choices, and then having to defend those choices as being both intellectually creative, you know, and sort of productive. And then your research, really, it means something to you. And so whenever you write and you put your ideas out there, you can't take them back. Right. You may change your ideas down the road, right? I know some people have talked about being embarrassed about early things they've written. And so I thought about it in terms of taking this approach to putting work out for people to read. What we're doing now, we're in a public space. We're talking about ideas. We get stuff wrong sometimes. We wish we had said something differently sometimes. But I thought about it as sort of an approach to engaging in dialogue in all these different formats in terms of our writing and our work, and what would it mean to be wholehearted with that? What would a wholehearted approach look like? And for me, it sort of looked like not holding on to an idea until I can turn it into my magnum opus, you know, and send it out into the world perfect. And it's the most exciting thing ever. But sort of just churning out ideas and bravely putting them out there. There's a faculty member here at Brandeis who is up at the Heller School, and he posts rejection letters on his office door. And he is well published. He has gotten millions of dollars from the NSF. His name's Ricardo Godoy. He's actually a trained anthropologist. You go by his door, and it's great to see all of these rejection letters to this, you know, very prolific guy that he still gets. So I liked vulnerability. I like the idea of this talk, and clearly she's handing the audience many things, but I imagine a lot of people take this into their own lives. And then sort of more on the intellectual front, I was really, in thinking about how much this circulated amongst people and how people celebrated it, and, you know, you should watch this. I was struck by how we talk about vulnerability, like it is such a great thing, how we sort of valorize it, maybe fetishize it. It's good just in its own sense. Like she links it, the end game that she links it to is having a life where you feel full and you feel worthy and you feel belonging and things like that.
Yeah.
But we do assign it very positive value just in and of itself. And so I thought that was really interesting. And that links in, you know, a lot to all of the literature on empathy, where when we first started talking about this topic, I was thinking, where does this show up in the literature? And one place is in, you know, anthropology of emotion, particularly in empathy. Because in order for there to be sort of an empathetic exchange, or for empathy to be happening, there's the empathizer, but there's also the empathizee who has to allow themselves to be seen in some way. They have to either let something show, they have to offer some feedback so that the empathizer sort of, you know, can check in with their interpretation of what's happening. And so it's this, there's a feedback loop with empathy. That's one of the only sort of, I think, general requirements that all of the scholars of empathy agree on in social anthropology. They agree that, you know, no matter whether or not people think it's a positive thing, it's a scary thing, no matter how far you think you can empathize into someone else's experience across cultures, everyone agrees that empathy is different from other similar emotions like sympathy or pity or something like that. Empathy is different because there is a feedback loop, and there has to be some way for you to check in on what's happening so that you can calibrate your response. That's what makes empathy real, or I guess different from just sympathy, where you project.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. I mean, and that's I think what we both run across too is that in a lot of the anthropological literature, but also just for thinking about this in general, that there is this challenge of how do we really share an emotional state with somebody else, right? That's sort of like, in kind of another way of saying this, I think I'm borrowing this from an article by Howland Throop, which we'll put on the website later. As you said, Amy, that empathy is sort of described in some ways as a shared emotional state, mm-hmm. whereas sympathy is more sort of a shared identity with somebody in some ways, like a shared identity state or something. And so, mm-hmm. And you can say I'm a happy person, but I don't know if that counts as your identity, right? You can say mm-hmm. we're sharing a happy moment because we understand something together. But and so it's interesting to think about, like, to what extent is this possible? Again, this isn't sort of a – I don't want to get too philosophical because it's just a question. As you're saying, it's like, how is it talked about, right? And, like, why is, as you said, empathy different from sympathy, from pity, right? Mm-hmm. And it has to do – you're right – with this feedback loop with the sharing notion or the shared emotional connection in some ways, right? And mm-hmm. this is a – again, what Michael Jackson writes about, and another sort of phenomenologist, which is that just means people that try to do a science of experience is kind of the way to say that. Mm-hmm. So phenomenology is the science of experience. But this notion of intersubjectivity, that we are subjective beings. We are subjects, not objects in this case. So intersubjectivity is like this. It's this sort of this shared state between us. And that's, again, it can be emotional. It can be notions of identity. It can be intrapsychic. We're thinking about something together. Intercorporeal, like we're dancing. Mm-hmm. Intravocal, we're having a conversation. Whatever. But it's how we're sort of building a notion of self together. Mm-hmm. And well, it sounds a little weird because it's like, well, how you know, they can't be, you know, two people in one self. But that's kind of what empathy sort of helps us. It blurs those lines a little bit, right? It's like, how do we relate to somebody in a way that we feel in some ways what they may be feeling, right? Again, as you said, sympathy seems to be sometimes kind of a projection, right? Mm-hmm. You know, I project what you must be feeling, but empathy is much more actually shared in some ways. And I don't know, it's worth drilling into, I think, you know.
Well, you mentioned, too, that – well, let me back up for a second. So this idea of feeling with – the idea that that is good and that that is an action and that that is comforting is very specific. It's yes. very contextual. And so here, to be empathetic with someone, you share in their feeling state with them. Hmm. You maybe take on some of their grief if they're grieving. You sit with them. You're sad with them. You know, you take on some fear with them and you'll sit with them and sort of mull over a difficult situation. But the idea that you are doing something just by feeling the same way as them or part of taking on part of what they're feeling is very specific to here. Douglas Holland, he and Jason Throp just put out sort of the latest book on the anthropology of empathy. I think it's back in 2011. And they take a very regional look at Micronesia to see, you know, they kind of put forth that you cannot look at empathy out of context. And so they've done this very deliberate regional look, and they hope that other people will do similar things, maybe not at the regional level, maybe at smaller scales, but so that an anthropology of empathy can sort of emerge, you need these very contextual accounts. But they talk, Jason Throp in particular, on the island of Yap in Micronesia, talks about how empathy is an action. So it doesn't mean much of anything, if at all, to feel something with someone. It's not until you do something because of that feeling.
Interesting, yeah.
Whether it means you bring food to someone's house, you know, because they've had a particularly busy day or some hardship where that would be helpful. But so this idea of needing to feel things for someone or being beholden to someone, like if you've done something wrong, you should feel sorry. So by you feeling this way, you have repaid a debt or you have made things right because you have felt the correct state, I think is very contextual. And so I like to talk about, we're already doing it, but talk about Brown's talk on several levels, what it means here for us, which is sort of the immediate personal responses that we both sort of shared. And I think a lot, you know, it's obvious with people circulating this stuff, but also contextually that this has there's such positive valence around this notion here in the U.S. And we can, of course, break that down by gender, because mm-hmm. I know it is not the same, right, for men and women here, the expectations placed on different genders. But anyway, so yeah, I think this notion of feeling as doing something or as meaning something is super interesting versus action.
That is interesting, yeah. I mean, that makes me think of, I mean, just in closer to my own field with food studies,
mm-hmm.
right? That a lot of the stuff we'll see in the Andes, in the Ecuadorian Andes, Mary Wise Mantel writes about, like, the bringing of food to other people. And actually, mm-hmm. like that, and even notions of sort of, Krista Van Vliet has a cool book called Performing Kinship. And I'm bringing this up because the idea of like even how a family works is actually by the actions that you do, by feeding them, by cutting hair, by literally raising the children, teaching them things. In that, one's parents can actually shift if the biological parents do not take care of a child, and then their aunt, uncle does, or some friends do. They literally become the parents of these children. And so it is this action. It doesn't matter what you think. It doesn't matter what your intention is either.
Yeah.
But the actions are what actually produce the result in this way, right? So it's very different from the idea of, do we feel the same way with somebody? Do I feel with you? It's like, maybe, you know, in the U.S., and that seems to be an important thing, but in the Andes, or obviously in the island of Yap in Micronesia, with Throop's example too, right? These ideas that it's the action that actually makes real, you know, the what we would say is an emotional state, which is really interesting to think about, you know, because again, that's the question of, do these things apply across culturally anyway? And we'd like to think they do, right? But again, that's always, that's the big, the challenge of anthropology anyway, which is why we go out and live amongst the people that we work with and study, you know, and try to bring back these stories. Because it is, it's a huge challenge.
Well, these two researchers put it in sort of a political economy lens, and they talk about how here, well, not just them, but it goes back to Arlie Hochschild, back with the managed heart. I believe it's in 79. I'm probably going to get that wrong. But she talked about, you know, the commercialization of feeling with flight attendants and with bill collectors who worked for Delta. And she – actually, hold on. I want to check something on my note.
Sure. It's all right. But that's what makes us think about it, though. I think that's a really comparative – or not comparative, but compelling thing to think about, that feelings themselves can be construed or driven a certain way, right? I mean, you got it? Okay.
Sorry, I found what I was looking for. I wanted to make sure it was her. But this notion – so as feelings have become commercialized in sort of the service industry, you know, where you present service with a smile, your job is to make somebody feel welcome – this notion of authenticity has gotten more and more important here. And so the idea that the financial or the economic should be separated from the authentic is becoming more and more prevalent. And so we think of, you know, love is not being about money. Or, you know, real authentic feelings and devotion don't have anything to do with the benefits that should flow from them. Where in a context where people are struggling, you know, in Micronesia, there are weather issues, you know, storms and things like that to deal with. There's also different food security issues. So where day-to-day life is a little bit more tenuous and your actual material security is more tenuous, taking care of someone does mean taking care of their material security. And that is not the case here, you know, because I think there is a level of assumption about people's material security being taken care of. Now, what I'm talking about, I think, too, is a very middle class, you know, view. Certainly in certain communities in the U.S., there are more communal ways of caring for people and pulling your resources together. But I think this sort of idealized view of feelings and empathy and care being separated from the world of money. Is very specific to our economic context.
No, it's a really, really powerful point. Actually, Daniel Miller writes about this in Shopping and among middle class families in North London. And there's this interesting mix, right? This notion of like morality and money don't go well together. And we've talked about this in the show a few times about the amorality of markets, right? But what he says specifically to your point is that the notion of a gift versus a commodity, like you want to go buy something or you want to give this specific thing to somebody special. And so you can think about these phrases where there's this mixture between morality and money in this case. Like, I need to get a gift for $10. You know, it's like, that sounds really weird. You think about it, you know, I'm going to get something special for somebody, but I got about 10 bucks to spend, you know. That's a very specific way to sort of talk about, you want to give, you know, some special thing from yourself, but only for 10 bucks. Or the flip side of that is what Millie looks at, is where, you know, a mother shopping for her kids will spend a little bit more on their favorite cereal because she knows that they like that, you know. And so it's weird because money, you're right, there's no way around it. Money still plays into these things. It's some, you know, again, we sort of brought this up before. It's like that money seeps into this. It is a moral, it's part of the moral economy, for lack of a better term, right, of how people think about, you know, what to do with it. But then it raises questions about, you said, of authenticity, right? Is it inauthentic to say I need a gift for $10? You know.
Let me clarify for a second.
Sure.
You're talking about in his work where he's interested in people and how they assess how much to spend on a gift, right?
Indeed,
like if this is a $30 friend or if this is a $10 friend, is that, okay.
You know, because it's seemingly, the seemingly amoral things, right? Like money's not supposed to be moral, but then you're right. And like, is this my $10 friend or my $30 friend, right? How close are we here? But then again, it comes back to these questions of authenticity that you were raising, which I think mm-hmm. is another fascinating point to think about. And something that you're right, in the U.S. and probably in parts of London too, like people are really concerned with. Like, mm-hmm. are my feelings, is somebody being authentic to me? Mm-hmm. And I think that's one of the reasons that this Brown talk went so viral. Mm. About vulnerability, because vulnerability in some ways is, as you said before too, that it's seemingly more authentic because it adds, in some ways I would say, a more human dimension to the economic person. Because again, we're treated as economic citizens, as people that live in a nation state, right? I mean, that's like our primary access to the government is economic people. Mm-hmm. You know, sorry if we want to pretend that it's like protected citizens, but it's not. I mean, we're mm-hmm. treated as like taxable, you know, mm-hmm. land yeah. renting yeah. citizens, you know. I mean, that's like we interact with the government primarily through economic means. And even though we may access roads and schools and stuff, you know, we're doing this in an economic way. But the thing is, like, so that's seen as, again, this amoral being, right? But then perhaps part of the power of this talk that came in, or that when it is so popular, is because it adds in some ways the other human element. And of course, being an economic person is a human thing too. Mm-hmm. But this notion of vulnerability, that like I'm not just a collection of numbers, mm-hmm. you know. But I have, whether it's self-doubts or just not sure about my material satisfaction, will I be satisfied? Will I be able to get what I even need, mm-hmm. you know, on a day-to-day basis, et cetera? And there's something that I think taps into that and says, like, we need to think about more holistically anyway. And so it's kind of cool because, like, the talk is popular, but I think we're kind of digging at it is the other side of what made it popular, right? What's mm-hmm. I mean, because I think it's filling in a gap in some ways, right? The popularity is that, oh, this is articulating something that has not been really spoken about super publicly.
Well, yeah, and would this talk make sense in other places? And mm-hmm. there are definitely places where it would not make sense yeah. at all.
Right.
So in Douglas Holland's context, in Micronesia, for him, he stresses the role of the empathizee, which mm-hmm. he says people don't talk about enough. And if you do not want someone to know that you are particularly sad, you probably could hide it very well, you know, mm-hmm. given who the person is and the circumstances. And so unless the empathizee or potential empathizee wants to be transparent or wants to be vulnerable, then it's not going to happen necessarily. You may end up mm-hmm. with something that looks more like sympathy or projection, you know?
Yeah.
And so the context, I think, makes all the difference. And she is speaking from a social work perspective, and I don't know enough about social work necessarily to really say how much it seems like they think, well, you know, from my one class in undergrad and my friends who are social workers, it seems that the assumption is that claims that she's making about sort of humanity would span the globe. And
yeah.
I say that with the exception of, I know that there is global social work, which does, I think, in my understanding, very limited understanding, takes a more specific approach, context-specific approach. But to me, that was a very interesting question. Where would this fit? Where would this not fit?
That is an interesting question, yeah. And that's you know, the good anthropological question, right?
Mm-hmm.
Does vulnerability in this way work cross-culturally with a specific explanation like we see in this TED talk? And I think you're saying it's like it doesn't necessarily, right?
No, not at all. Well, and in a place where to be empathetic is only a state of feeling with someone,
mm-hmm.
it might not be as dangerous. Because, you know, if I show my true colors in a moment to someone who I don't necessarily trust, maybe there'll be gossip, you know, maybe something of mm-hmm. that nature would happen. But in a context where empathy means action, like the giving of food or taking care of, the converse, you know, if someone you don't trust is able to empathize with you and know what's happening, they could also act in a malicious way. And so mm-hmm. somewhere where empathy means action, it could become a much more dangerous phenomenon to let happen than mm-hmm. here, where it just means someone feels the same thing as you, or
right.
they can access sort of your feeling state.
Yeah. Again, there's no guarantee. Like, that's what you're saying, because we think of empathy as a very positive thing here
definitely,
in the United States, right?
Definitely.
And there's no guarantee that that's going to be the case anywhere else, or even here for that matter, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you show somebody, like, this is actually how I'm feeling, you know, they may exploit that.
Yeah.
You know, which is not to say don't be empathetic or don't share your true self, whatever that is, you know. But it raises an interesting question, right? Because we want to say it's a positive thing, and that's this talk too kind of gives that positive vibe. Actually, I read a really interesting critique about TED Talks in general.
I think there's a lot of those floating around now. Yeah.
For whatever reason, and one of them in this case, this is really good to think about. What this is, this one is actually from Alternet, the kind of the interesting lefty Politico website. But he's talking about that what TED Talks do. Well is inspire people, but what they don't do well is inspire them to do anything.
Interesting.
And so it's kind of like seeing a nice sermon on Sunday at church, but then you go out and don't do anything with it, for the week. And so, of course, some people might, but in general, because this is a very inspiring talk. And as we were saying, we can see it feels universal in some ways. But I guess our task as anthropologists is to then think about what does it mean when something is claimed to be universal, and what we're saying here, this is a very specific understanding of empathy, which I think is powerful and worth, as we're digging through it also, because this deserves to be really thought about and digested. But as well as asking the question of as we're saying, you can't necessarily take it and apply it in Micronesia, because people don't necessarily use empathy the same way. And that's why we may have a biological capacity for empathy. Right.
Yes.
But the cultural context in which it's deployed is going to be different, right? We may have an idea that there may be some universals, and so what we could do actually. So let's think about some of the universals we might see, whether biologically or culturally, that people will do in terms of empathy. Mm. But then also, of course, these are going to be deployed a little bit differently, right? So one of the questions is why do we have empathy? And we have actually, I think it was episode 4, back in November of last year, we did do an episode on violence and empathy, and it was much more so about the violence part, but why empathy sort of works with violence, and we see them come together in that, what is violence an attack on it in different capacities? And so I won't recap that episode, but there's some cool stuff on chimpanzee warfare and bonobos. Using sex to get out of conflict. Very much nicer way than going to war, I think. To think about it now, it's the idea of what kind of things do we see people using? What sort of things do we respond to by being empathetic? How do we sort of think about an ethics of empathy in this way, right?
Well, I know in the literature that it seems to be sort of three ways that it's talked about. One way is as an ethnographic phenomenon, which is what we're doing now, right? We're talking about it in context. The second way is empathy as a method for anthropologists, which is something that we, Clifford Geertz talked about the perils of thinking that you're empathizing with someone when you're not getting it right. And Jason Thropp does a really good job in talking about a funeral that he attended on the island of Yap. But so that's the second way, is us thinking about empathy as a potential method. And then the third way is thinking about empathy more in how you're talking about it now is maybe a biological phenomenon or the universals around it. And so thinking about sort of degrees of empathy, where at a very low level, the ability to understand what someone else is doing or to interpret their actions or to be able to make assumptions about their actions based on maybe your shared context, right? You are a student on campus. If I see you laying in the grass, you're probably not passed out. You're probably reading or, assumptions that I can make. That is a basic part of our sociality. We have to make assumptions on a regular basis. Otherwise, we sort of couldn't perform any sort of, interaction successfully. And with that notion that empathy, taking it to a very low level and thinking about understanding one another, before you get to any of the more emotional sort of sharing or material sharing stuff, with that comes the biological component, which has really spurred research on empathy and vulnerability in anthropology over the past 8-10 years, which has been the discovery of mirror neurons. Where now it's understood that if I see you doing something, the parts of my brain that would light up if I were to be doing it, they are activated just because I see you performing the action. And so there is some biological capacity for sort of understanding or intuitively sort of grasping what's happening with the other person, maybe on a very basic level. That I think is one way to think about it universally. And then another thing that I think is particularly interesting that has everything to do with Brené Brown's talk is this one gesture that theorists seem to agree is sort of universal, and they're very hesitant, right, to agree that anything about this is universal. Mm-hmm. But the one sort of more behavioral thing was the look away, where if you see someone and you anticipate that they're about to be embarrassed because of something, mm-hmm. you gracefully or you graciously sort of look away and give them a moment to collect themselves. So, you know, someone who, I don't know, there was a, I saw a girl once on the subway who had her skirt tucked into the back of her tights, mm-hmm. and several people saw it. You know, it was kind of this nervous look around of who's going to tell, you know, this poor girl, right? Because mm-hmm. once you tell her, she knows everybody's seen it. And so a woman sort of quietly leaned over and said something to her, and she looks alarmed and she goes to fix her skirt. I looked away, and mm-hmm. I'm sure that other people around must have looked away because you give her a moment, right? Yeah. You don't want her to know that you've just seen that. And that happens cross-culturally. Mm-hmm. This look away moment does.
That's interesting. Yeah. So, I mean, it does, there's something about it then, right? That, and whether that's like, you know, whether that's a mirror neuron that your brain is like saying, you're embarrassed and I'm embarrassed also because mm-hmm. we're both embarrassed right now. There's an embarrassing thing happening.
Mm-hmm. Just happens I'm embarrassed
to be,
for you.
Happens to be your pants though. Yeah. but at the same time, you know, it's there's something, you're right. This idea that it's interesting because there is, as you said, this hesitancy to say anything is universal in this capacity, right? That we mm-hmm. see something that we all tend to do. Humans, most places tend to do this thing, right? Mm-hmm. But this is one of them. And I think the idea of looking away when something either embarrassing or somebody needs a moment, they're having an emotional moment, they're having a cry or something.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It really raises some cool questions you know, this biology kind of versus culture, like when it comes to mm-hmm. people again, because there's actually been a big push in anthropology too in the last five, you know, maybe the longer years to like reintegrate biological and cultural
to reground
together,
things
right?
in the body. Yeah.
And like body thinking is not new, right? That's mm-hmm. sort of been, you know, at least pushed since the 70s. But to reground sort of the biological basis of the body too, mm-hmm. right? And whether that's because of advances in neurology and psychology and other studies in biology, you know, I'm not really sure. But it does raise interesting questions. I mean, so that it made me think of Eleanor Oakes does some interesting work too. She does linguistic anthropology, thinking about language, but with autistic people,
mm-hmm.
and sort of raises the questions of how do we think about empathy in this capacity? How do we think about how we identify even mirror neurons too? How do we identify with somebody else, emotionally identify with somebody else in some capacity,
mm-hmm.
When their, you know, their ability to speak is severely different,
mm-hmm.
Or their ability to communicate.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and again, it raises questions also of intentionality. This is something that we see a lot in literature with empathy, too. It's like, is somebody intending to feel a certain way?
Mm-hmm.
Am I trying to empathize with you? But again, also, she raises interesting questions, Oakes does, of like, what happens when we're not necessarily talking about cultural differences here, but we're talking about, in some ways, some neurological differences
mm-hmm.
or something, right? In communicative capacities.
Mm-hmm.
And so it raises cool questions for the empathizer and empathizee, as you brought up before, too, right? We're talking about sort of differently abled people. You know, she doesn't have conclusions right now, but there's a mm-hmm. question to raise, like, mm-hmm. how do we think? We need to be, again, specifically contextual about when we're thinking of relating to someone else or mm-hmm. when you talk about empathy. How do these happen in different ways, right? And even if there are still these universals that we see, it's like the look away or something.
Well, there's a lot of assumptions with – and I do love Brown's talk, but since we are sort of, you know, pulling things apart and digging in a little bit, there are a lot of assumptions about someone being able to, someone having a very clear understanding of everything they're feeling.
Mm-hmm.
So if I am going to be vulnerable and allow myself to be seen, there are assumptions about personhood that we have emotions. That emotions, you know, or these vulnerabilities are very true, that mm-hmm. those are sometimes more true than our ideas, that they're reflexive, that we don't have a lot of control over them all the time. And so that those are this very authentic part of ourselves or expression of ourselves, that we can understand them and that we could articulate them, you know, mm-hmm. if someone were to be safe and to want to understand us, that I could express to them, you know, what's happening right now. And so there's a lot of assumptions about how emotions work, and about what we are conscious of and capable of communicating to one another that's happening with all of this, that researchers are sort of trying to pull apart. And I think that they come up on these questions about what is even possible to access, because to try to research any of this is phenomenally complex. You know, mm-hmm. if people are not interested in making themselves vulnerable and transparent, then how in the world would you try to research what's going on, you know,
right.
without sort of attributing some theory of false consciousness or trying to use, you know, if you don't have a predilection towards psychoanalytic theory, how would you try to even talk or think about what's happening for a person who does not want to be understood?
Hmm. Yeah.
So
wow.
I might have just dug us into a how do we talk about this? But it is something, yeah. It's, so some the way that some people have gone about that is to look at socialization for children
mm-hmm.
and how adults teach children to sort of name their feelings, maybe how intensely adults try to teach children that they should monitor themselves. Because in some contexts, monitoring yourself and sort of psychoanalyzing yourself regularly to check on your own emotional state is not something that is valued or that happens.
Yeah.
And here we certainly do a lot of that.
Right. And, you know, we almost take it for granted, right, in that way, because, you know, if you're trained a certain way, particularly at the university, right?
Mm-hmm.
But it's even what Hallinan and Threw point out in the article that, again, we'll reference on the website, but is that empathy? We have to think about it. It's like it's got to be seen in this bigger context of how people gain knowledge of each other,
mm-hmm.
right? And what they don't want to share, what they do choose to reveal, how mm-hmm. these ideas are challenged. You know, or again, also like with children too, how kids are socialized into expressing themselves,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
There are particular ways you should express yourself, and even like thinking about cognitive behavioral therapy, right? You know, with autistic children, right?
Yeah.
I mean, there's the ideas of like positive reinforcement of like you can. And with, I mean, there's sort of ways of adapting someone's behavior. Like,
mm-hmm.
you know, you want to sort of get them, particularly again, when we're talking with autistic folks. I've got some friends that work with autistic kids. And like, the idea, it's interesting to sort of think about the methods, right? These behavioral methods of positive reinforcement, of like sort of helping, or the idea is to sort of help shape the way behavior is expressed, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because again, they're differently expressing, mm-hmm. they're differently cognitively appropriate in the world anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's like finding the bridge between those two. And I don't know, it's really worth thinking through more, because again, it's like these contexts of how these people choose to be known, right? And again, of course, as a social scientist, that's what we're trying to get after. But as, mm-hmm. as you're pointing out, like some people don't even want to or conceptualize that they're feeling certain things and then trying to express them a certain way,
mm-hmm.
right? And it's an incredible barrier. You know, it's not that it can't be overcome, but it raises questions to the limits of our own research methods, right? How do we even talk about the psychology of somebody else or the, let alone to get at something like empathy, right?
I think in those contexts, the thing that you end up saying is that people don't want to be known.
Right.
That's, you know, what's happening, and that's as far as you get.
Right.
And that becomes the interesting thing, you know, especially for us, because to be loved, to be intimate is all about being known. You know,
yeah,
we
yeah.
place such a premium on vulnerability, intimacy, you know,
mm-hmm.
in those contexts. I wanted to shift a little bit to gender in our context,
yes.
Because I know that some of the empathy literature has dealt with gender
mm-hmm.
and whether or not empathy is a gendered phenomenon. And then how in certain sort of very gender normative practices or performances, how empathy is sort of it's disciplined out of someone. And here I'm thinking about the military in particular,
mm.
how, you know, to be very, it's changing now, obviously women are in the military, but historically to be masculine, you know, is to be able to shut empathy off, especially in a combat situation, to be able to do what you need to do. Is to actively shut off your empathy mechanism, because if you don't, you might not be able to take someone else's life, you know,
yeah.
in a moment where that is what you are supposed to be doing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, it raises questions of, in some ways, right, of classification. Like, so it's an interesting idea, right, because there is sort of this human element that needs to be shut down in the military context of empathy, right, that I empathize
mm-hmm.
that this is another person I'm looking at who probably has a family like I do.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
they live just somewhere else. But in this context, they are the enemy, and I am the friend. You know, like this is again a different way of reading what people are. But it's a really interesting and challenging thing to think about, right? Particularly again, as you said, because of gender, right? It's that in some ways What we see actually a lot of things across culture, like comparatively with gender, right? That a lot of malehood or man, you know, manliness has to be made in the same way that, you know, Sherry Ordner writes about that. It seems that we see a lot of times that women are seen to just sort of grow into being women, but men mm-hmm. have to be made, right? Mm-hmm. And so that idea seems a little more foreign to our, you know, maybe listeners right now, because we don't have rites of passage the same way that if we talk about the Sambia or something, that like mm-hmm. they have these very specific 7-year-long becoming a man rituals, mm-hmm. you know, that involve being totally isolated from other women, et cetera, et cetera. And so, so we were talking about these are socialization processes. And so with gender, too, this is a socialization thing, right? And again, the military is a specific kind of socialization that in some level, as you point out, is designed to get rid of empathy on a level that, you know, can be shut off on the battlefield or something.
Mm-hmm. I think there's a really great piece by Katie Glaskin that came mm-hmm. out in 2012. And it's called Empathy in the Robot, Neuroanthropological Analysis. And she talks to roboticists and goes to, I think, some robot conventions, mostly in Japan, if I'm remembering correctly. And one of the main findings is that for humans to empathize with a robot or to believe that a robot is empathizing with them, they have to be able to anthropomorphize the robot. And mm-hmm. by that, you first have to assume that something else has a mind, yeah. you know, like we do, or are sort of ethno models of what a mind is. You have to be able to attribute it that, and then sort of these characters of being able to, or these qualities of being able to feel something. Mm-hmm. And so robots, you know, are designed to seem as though they have a mind and as though they are feeling something. I thought that linked in with the military stuff and the gendered stuff. A little bit here. I'm getting sidetracked because I'm looking up her article.
That's fine. When you said robots, it actually made me think of a really interesting article that I came across a little while ago that was talking about genetic scientists as sociocultural entrepreneurs. Mm. And one of the things is talking about AI with robots and actually in Japan and the development of robots with AI emotions. So not okay. just that they have a sort of thinking logical mind, but that they can feel certain things. And what really struck me about this is that, I'm going to get meta here for a second, but like the idea of like, come back to gender too, is that like when we're talking about like the quote rational citizen, right? It's seen as in the economic citizens, as I brought up before, like since European Enlightenment in the 1600s, the idea that there is this economic being that is rationally calculating their own self-interest, homo economicus, yeah. right? This rational, self-interested individual that is dispassionately trying to find the best way to maximize their own outcomes, their mm-hmm. own their own, you well know, said. Their ends. And now what's missing from this thing, or not missing from, but intentionally not there, is emotional capacity, right? And then if we think about engendered capacity, right, that the idea of the homo economicus was attributed to men, mm-hmm. right, and then women were seen as the emotive capacity, right? Mm-hmm. And if you think of any you know, stereotypical way of talking about gender, this is one of the main ones, that women are more emotional, right? Mm-hmm. This is not necessarily true by any means, right? This is a socialization process as well as a myth that we tell ourselves. Now, when it comes to robots and AI, what really kind of struck me about this is the opposite is the case, is that when we see just a purely cold, calculating, logical robot, we think of T-1000 from Terminator, and it's terrifying, or Michael Fassbender's character from Prometheus. Like, it's this robot that is doing just its job, which is to understand more about the world or something. Mm-hmm. And it's terrifying because they don't get human emotions, so they just do things that actually get people killed in the name of science, in the name mm-hmm. of cold, rational calculation, of actually maximizing their knowledge. However, the flip side of this is that now that's seen as like a low-level AI, mm-hmm. but the higher-level AI is actually an emoting robot, the one that can emote. Mm-hmm. And so it's mm-hmm. the opposite of actually economic, rational man. Mm-hmm. And it's sort of it's cool to me because it's like this is the next step of AI information, then the sort of AI robot programming. And so it's this flip of actually the European model of what like a good human economic person is.
Do you think that reflects a growing understanding of this sort of a lay understanding of a full human being, a feeling human?
I mean, I think so on some levels, yeah. I mean, mm-hmm. I got to be, you know, contextual here and say that we're talking about European ideas of humanity versus the Japanese idea of how AI and a robot works. But nonetheless, I think since we do have the ability and capacity to think cross-culturally here, yeah, I think in some ways there is a recognition of that, right? Because there is, I mean, think about just the idea of like the monster movie, right? There's always this the fear of the monster is that it's this unfeeling sociopathic, it doesn't have an emotive capacity, right? As attractive as Dexter is as a TV show, you know, like beside that, you know, that like sociopathy is pretty scary and psychopathology is scary because these people don't feel emotions. There's no conscience in this way, you know? And so when you apply that to a robot, it's somewhat even scarier, I think, for a lot of people, because then it's like, you can't, how do you, because the question is, how do you relate? And so while there's sort of this touted, you know, plus sometimes of like, I want to, you know, become a strong business person and like really understand markets. Coming back to Brown and robots and the whole thing, the whole shebang, right, is that there is this emotive capacity that we have as people that is being shut out by this other way of thinking, this purely economic way of thinking. And so I don't know if robots in some ways give us a response to that, but like it raises an interesting question, right? And what's cool too actually is like, is this a gendered thing? I'm not really sure. Like again, it's not like we need to add the female component to the male or some weird thing like that that's totally wacky. But there's a recognized capacity that something's missing in AI, artificial intelligence, when it's just logic, right?
I think it does speak to the Brown a little bit because the robot example, if it does not feel or recognize feelings and then take those into account into its own sort of, you know, algorithms, what it's doing, what it's supposed to be doing. The reason that is so scary is because when you see human vulnerability that is supposed to influence what you're doing in some way as another human, right? It's supposed to tug at you in some way. And so if a robot is able to look human vulnerability in the face and it does not tug at its quote unquote heartstrings, that is petrifying. And I think, as you mentioned, like with sociopathology and things, it is terrifying because there is no mechanism to sort of stop what's happening. There is no moment that will give pause to the aggressor, whether it's a robot, you know, or whatever we're talking about in this situation. So I think it definitely links back to this vulnerability and what we think vulnerability in our cultural context is supposed to do. It's supposed to be able to tug at other people's hearts and maybe make a difference in a moment. And that's, you know, why you have to turn it off for combat, you know, you turn it off in sort of certain competitive. Maybe in boxing, you have to turn it off, because if you didn't turn it off, how in the world can you keep hitting someone in the face, right? Maybe because you know you're about to get hit in the face, but
But even in a business meeting, right? If you got to market something and sell it, right? There's no space for saying, well, I was really nervous to come here today. It's like, no, you're going to launch into your pitch. You got 4 minutes, you know?
Yeah. Or an attorney, right? In a certain setting where you're supposed to be competitive and... It's an adversarial system, and so if you were to acquiesce to someone and admit, you know, what's really going on, you're really putting yourself at a disadvantage strategically.
Yeah. and that's, again, why it comes back to I think one of the reasons that the power of vulnerability is such a powerful TED Talk, right? Because it says, like, we need that moment to stop. We need that heartstring tug to be able to stop the juggernaut that is the system, that is the other person boxing my face, the other person on the battlefield or something. Or to make the robot stop for a second and say, oh, okay, I get that you're feeling scared right now. You know,
the gender go ahead. The gender aspect, I'm thinking about masculinity. And on one hand, you know, we see so much violence against LGBTQ youth in school with bullying and things that, you know, upon sight of vulnerability, it becomes a dangerous situation for some kids to be perceived as vulnerable, soft, feeling, and all these things.
Yeah.
But for a man who has already established himself as sort of, you know, uber masculine, sort of the pinnacle of masculinity, being vulnerable becomes sort of, because of male privilege, it becomes this sort of asset and this celebrated thing. And I'm thinking back to what has to have been one of the most obnoxious little news blips I have ever seen. And it was Michael Jordan was at his son's graduation. He was at something that had to do with his children, one of his kids, and he cried in public and it was on the news. It made news that this man cried. Now, when Hillary Clinton, I think, shed a tear or two once in public, we, you know, she goes from being this scary pantsuit wielding, you know, she monster to, you know, is she tough enough to run the country, right? Mm-hmm. It automatically becomes sort of this liability for her. But Michael Jordan cries and we all applaud, you know, yeah. this tough man really having a soft side and things like that. And the fact that it even made news, I thought, spoke to, you know, it spoke to levels of subjugation for men, right? Mm-hmm. Where some men, for some men, that is a dangerous act. Yeah. But then for other men who have already proven themselves on this hierarchy of masculinity, it definitely becomes an asset.
That's really interesting, yeah. I mean, again, it minimally speaks to the Howard Zinn point that you can't be neutral, right? It's like there's nobody outside of the system.
Yeah.
And that's an important thing to remember, too, because when we do talk about gender ever on the show or racism or sexism, it can be difficult because then it sounds like, well, somebody's perpetuating this violence. And this is when it comes to structural issues, too. Like men and women are both equally implicated in this whole system, right? I mean, there is certain perpetuations of violence, no doubt. But at least to realize that we can't be outside of it, though. You know? Yeah,
I would definitely say we can't be outside of it. I take issue with some feminist scholars who talk about it as a system so much that I think they take away the moment where it's important for somebody to be accountable. Like, I have male privilege. Let's talk about what that means.
Right.
If we talk about it just in a very abstract, systematic way, I think the responsibility or sort of impulse for bringing it down and grounding it in everyday practices where privilege actually does accumulate in very real ways to some people and they enjoy it and they keep going with it, whether it's white privilege, you know, male privilege, whatever, straight privilege. Let's have a show on gender and privilege
Sounds
or
good.
Privileges, you know, the multiple.
I think it's great. I think it's an incredibly challenging topic. And certainly difficult to riff off of, but it's worth doing. But I mean, even to think about one of the things that Brown says towards the end of her TED Talk, which is good to think about in this moment, is that with so much with vulnerability, we try to tamp it down. We try to numb it, whether it's through pharmaceuticals or trying
food.
To exploit certain kind of privileges, food, or whatever, right? There's a way to sort of work around it. And this, again, comes back to also individual choice in this capacity. Right? There's certain ways that we're trying to do that. People choose different ways, but also that we may want to not feel vulnerable. But one of the ways, one of the effects of doing this that she says, which I think is a really powerful point, is that it helps people think that what they do doesn't have an effect on somebody else. Because if I'm not vulnerable, you must not be vulnerable, right?
Yeah.
And we pretend that it's not there. Particularly, again, if we're talking about this sort of rational economic market system. It's like, well, whatever. I mean, I'm not doing this. It's just the market.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
as if that somehow doesn't have an effect on somebody else.
Mm-hmm.
The way that, you know, whether business practices exploit the poor.
As though the market is not made up of all of our individual actions.
Exactly.
And then it's emergent properties, clearly. But, yeah, as though that's not the foundation of it.
Yeah. And so it's interesting because, I mean, in some ways she ties all of that back to individual vulnerability and our desire, at least in the United States, to sort of suppress that in some levels, right? And that's why, you know, this talk is powerful in terms of, let's bring that back up. Let's actually talk about that. We are vulnerable because what we do does affect other people. And this is, you know, again, we talk about privilege too, which is really a good thing to think about, is that it's huge effects, right? Our individual choices as well as, you know, the unconscious cultural forces that sort of, you know, push us to work and act certain ways, you know what I mean? It's this weird mix of both these things, right?
I'm glad you bring that up because I'm thinking back now on how I listened to the talk.
Yeah.
And when you said that TED Talks are great for motivating people but not motivating them to do something.
Yeah.
Right? So I hear this talk and I'm thinking about how I need to challenge myself to be more vulnerable, you know, what I put out in the world, this and that. And I hadn't even gone the next step to think about how, well, if I'm vulnerable, they're vulnerable also. But I'm really glad you brought that up. Because, and I would like to do a little mini ethnography, you know, ask people on Facebook who took that next step, right?
Right.
Is the TED Talk something you take in and you motivate yourself with and it stops there? Not that, you know, that's the most interesting part of this, but yeah, I think that is an excellent point. The next step to vulnerability is that if I'm vulnerable, you are also vulnerable.
Yeah.
You know?
And to think about, you know, come to circle back to empathy, that's the key point, right? Mm-hmm. You need both empathizer and empathizee here. It can't just be one-sided vulnerability. It's going to, empathy's got to have, if it's a shared emotional state, it's got to be two, at least, right? So, yeah, I think it's really kind of cool to think, maybe if one day a little ethnography on that, and we can
put it report
on the,
back.
On the website, exactly. Report back, you know.
Excellent.
But man, what a great episode.
It's been
interesting circling around the world. And certainly fun to think through these issues. I mean, these are tough issues, and I think we'll certainly come back to these again and again. Like, this is sort of a way of us introducing notions of empathy and vulnerability, right, and especially gender. And so what we'll do next week is we'll kind of tie some of these ideas more specifically to how to talk about terrorism and terror. It'd be more specifically about Boko Haram as well as the Taliban and sort of different ways that we can think about terror in the world and terror organizations in this capacity. But how they do make us think about vulnerability, about empathy, and challenge those notions. And of course, you know, how these things may affect other people very, specifically, contextually, et cetera. But again, thanks for joining us, listeners, today on This Anthropological Life. This is Adam Gamwell.
This is Amy Haynes.
And have a pleasant week, and we'll see you back at a regular time next week on Tuesday at 1, I believe. And until then, stay tuned and stay crazy.